All right.
This is tape 3, side A.
All right, and today is April 20th, 2004. You wanted to add something to the record before we began.
Right, this is just a little bit about my times in Madison, because we were discussing how we were spending time there. And one thing that I remember fondly was just one of the ways I've been spending time with the friend of mine, Helena, was that we were both volunteering in Civic Center in Madison. For me, that was a new concept, because in Poland you either have theater or you have opera or you have Philharmonie, and the Civic Center in Madison is this typical, now I know it's typical for US, where you have a stage which can be anything, and we've been ushering usually two or three times per month, and that really provided an opportunity for me to see a variety of shows from theater through some performance like Philip Glass or Peter, Paul and Mary. So it was sort of a window for me into American culture and have a nice survey. So that was just one of the things that I spent many evenings there. Mm-hmm. And I saw a lot of Nutcracker performances near the Christmas time as well.
Very popular.
Yeah.
How about here? Do you still do things like that here?
I still do things like that. I'm not ushering anymore. There is actually, Vanderbilt has a similar venue, much smaller, but they have a stage which they use in a similar fashion. So you can have... you can have dance, and modern dance is actually something that I enjoy very much, and whenever there is a performance I try to go. But they also have concerts on the stage, or sometimes play, or some other type of music. And of course there is a Tennessee Performing Arts Center in downtown, which also has a number of performances. There is also a School of Music, and they have a very nice concert hall and a concert series by outside and also inside musicians, and that's something that we go quite frequently. Sometimes I'm invited by my students for their performances, which is a unique type of concert,
right.
but very, very nice way of spending time as well.
Mm-hmm. All right, when we last left, when we last spoke, we had left off with you about to join the Drever Lab,
mm-hmm.
and you talked about the teaching that you had done at Madison and how that helped you find the topics,
mm-hmm.
the topic that you wanted to focus on in the Drever
Lab.
Right,
right.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, how large was the Drever Lab when you entered?
When I entered... when I arrived, actually, I was the first postdoc. So
right.
There was Wolfgang, who was still very, very young, because he finished his PhD. He had this amazing series of papers from his work on Drosophila. And after a very, very short postdoctoral period, he started his own lab. And when I contacted him, he was just putting his group together. So when I arrived in Boston in October 1991, there was just one research assistant who came with him from Germany, Lisa, and Wolfgang himself, and about couple of months later, another postdoc, Zehava Rangini, arrived from Israel, and that was our lab actually for the first year.
Mm-hmm.
And then it exploded. We accepted several postdocs came next year and then next year. So eventually, at the end of my stay, the group was over 10 people.
Right, so it grew very, very fast.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And describe Drever's lab management style. You had never met him before, I take it.
No,
that you
no.
showed up
mm-hmm.
at his doorstep.
Well, I think his management style, he was learning himself, and that actually was one of my motivations to go to his lab, because I thought that seeing somebody starting own lab will be a good lesson for me to do it in the future. Sometimes when you join, I mean, when you are in a lab like Bill Duff's lab, the lab that existed for over 20 years, everything works smoothly. It's like a machine, that well-oiled machine, that you don't really see the workings of it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you see a lab forming. It's a very educational experience. So I've seen it, and the style changed. Initially, I think he was just so excited to have the first postdoc that for the first 3 weeks he would just follow me with everything I've been doing, trying to figure out if he made a big mistake of hiring me right. or not. But after that, I think he realized, okay, she knows what she's doing, and he got a little bit more relaxed. And then he's, I think he was overeager, and he tried, for example, to pressure me, but. I just told him very plainly, Wolfgang, the negative incentives do not work with me. I respond with aggression, or I respond right. I respond with negative. My response is negative and definitely does not motivate me. So I say, work only with positive incentives. So you see, he was learning, and we could communicate pretty well, actually. Me and other postdocs, he was very much open to what we were thinking, but he was extremely well organized. That's something that I learned is absolutely essential for the type of projects we have been doing when we were handling really large number of animals and lines of animals, and it's a project eventually, because at the beginning we were establishing methods of mutagenesis, so we did not have that complexity. But at the end of the project, we had hundreds of fish crosses set up, hundreds of mutants to handle. So big logistic type of operation that needed very good coordination. That's what he was excellent at, mm-hmm. setting up databases, making sure that they are people responsible for directing other people, so the whole operation goes smoothly.
Right. Yeah. Well, why don't you talk then a little bit about the evolution of your research there? When you went in, did you know more or less what you had a clear idea what you were going to do?
That's correct. We've discussed at length once he decided to accept me, and that's actually also a nice story, because initially he said no. When he was very eager to take me into the lab, but at the time when I met him, he already committed himself to this Israeli postdoc. He mm-hmm. said, well, I will support you. So when I contacted him, he said, well, I don't have any more positions. And we decided that I will write fellowship proposals and just join his lab. So he said initially no, but then I thought about it quite a lot, and then I wrote to him that that's the only lab I want to go to. That's the only thing I want to do. Mm-hmm. And if it takes for me to wait a year or two, I don't mind. And at that point, he said, fine, let's just go ahead. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that simply he had additional money to accept me into his lab, and so I could start without any delay.
Right.
But at the time when once he made this decision, we talked at length, you know, what I'm going to do. And from the very beginning, there were two projects. One project was to develop methods of efficient mutagenesis in zebrafish. Some methods already existed, but we wanted to achieve a special type of mutagenesis which targets spermatogonia in fish, and then would allow a specific type of recovery of mutants in three-generation breeding scheme. There were really two basic options to go. We could either use EMS, which is one mutagen, or ENU, which is another type of mutagen. And I was very much pro-ENU because that's what mouse geneticists were doing, and Wolfgang was pro-EMS because that's what Drosophila geneticists were doing. So we tried both methods. And eventually, once I started to do experiments, and that was pretty frustrating period of time, because you are doing experiments, and obviously you are putting animals in conditions almost such that many of them initially, when I was setting the doses, some animals would not survive. So it was difficult for me to go through this. We had to go through this, and eventually we arrived with very efficient method. deciding that ENU is a much better option. So that was year number one. It took me half a year to establish these conditions. And then at the beginning of February, I went for a meeting. After 5 months in the lab, I went to a meeting in UK. And then when I came back, we could test some of the males that I mutagenized with certain conditions. And then these tests really showed that the method is working. So that was the first big moment for me, that this method works. And then once this method was established, we knew we can now generate large numbers of families and then screen them for the defects you would be interested in.
Right.
So that was one project, and parallel to that project, I've been also working on cytoskeleton. That's something that I've been doing in my slime mold during my PhD, and we thought that that would be a nice avenue for me to pursue in fish. So that project also just looking at how the cytoskeleton, particularly microtubules, are organized in the zebrafish embryo. And then we discovered that they participate in some of the gastrulation movements that I was very much interested. So that was a very, very nice project for me. And that also allowed me to just spend a lot of time with embryos. And that's what I've been doing throughout, actually, these years, just staring at embryos quite a lot. And that's in relation to what we were discussing yesterday, what's really an important aspect of discovery. And in biology, especially developmental biology, you need to know your subject. It's like, you know, a good physician. You need to know the body and how the body works to be able to figure out what's wrong with a sick body. The same is with developmental biologists. You need to know your embryo, because only then you can, when you look at defective embryo, you can figure out what's the defect. Mm-hmm. So I spent a lot of time on the microscope, just doing experiments and just watching the embryos. And that was also very important preparation for the genetic screen, to be able then just to look at the mutant phenotypes.
Right.
So at the end of the first year, the methods were of mutagenesis were established, and we had a lot of lines growing. And then for the next 2 years, we were 2.5 years, we've been just carrying this large-scale screen, when we screened over 2,000 families of fish by crossing them. And so that was, on one hand, very... as I told you, very sort of complex in terms of organization thing, and just also a lot of very, very busy work, setting up crosses, collecting embryos, looking at embryos and finding the mutants, deciding what is interesting, what is not interesting. And at that point, we were joined by several really fantastic people, which made the next 3 years an absolute fantastic experience for me. Some of the postdocs who joined the lab, Alex Scheer, Derek Stempel, Jarema Malicki, really extremely talented people, and just made it fun to work. Some graduate students also, Salim Abdelilah and Stefan Neuhaus. We had just great time to work together and find these mutants. Nobody has really found many mutants in zebrafish before, so we did not know what we were going to find. And as we were finding them, we've trying to figure out what's interesting, what is not, trying together to identify some patterns in what we were finding.
Right, and you did that in the last part of your postdoc, I think.
Well, actually, we did it throughout, because at the beginning, after we screened the first few hundred lines, we could not keep all the mutants we have found, because we have found hundreds. Mm-hmm. The way we've been looking for everything that somehow affects development of the fish until day five of the development. And at day five, the little fish can eat, can see. So we were looking for very broad spectrum of defects, in part to describe the spectrum of defects that the fish mutagenized fish can give you. So we had too much to handle, and therefore we had to decide what we are going to keep. And to be able to do that, we had immediately assess what we had. And for example, it was pretty obvious that about 30% of all mutants we were finding was very early degeneration of central nervous system. Mm. There were so many of them that we said, well, even if they are interesting in some interesting genes, we cannot simply keep them. And most likely they are not in some very interesting genes. They are probably just required for some what we call in biology housekeeping genes, genes, you know, very busy genes that are needed for survival of a cell, but they are not involved in specifying, you know, where the forebrain and where the midbrain is going to be. So we decided that we are not going to keep these mutants, and as we were going through, we were finding new classes of mutants and deciding, okay, this is interesting, and this is what we are going to keep. Mm-hmm. So the whole project work was a continuous assessment, and the project was organized in a different manner than a parallel effort by Janinus Lein-Volhard in Germany. Our effort was much more individualistic, so everybody had own lines designated to them, and we were screening on our own. And then we were finding these mutants, and all the mutants were then presented at the group meeting, and it was almost like a little competition. You had to defend your mutant.
Right.
What's interesting in this mutant that we are going to keep it?
Right.
And then once the mutant was accepted, it was given a name, and that was, of course, also a source of entertainment, because some classes of mutants got funny names. For example, when we started to find mutants in which we couldn't see any blood cells, then Alex decided to call the first one Vampire, and then the next one was called Nosferatu, and you know, all the vampire names.
That's great.
So we had a lot of fun with that.
Well, one of the key ones, Bozo.
Bozozok. That's the...
Explain that.
Bozozok. So whoever found the mutant could name it. And actually, Jarema Malicki, who was another Polish person in the lab, found most of the mutants that I am interested in, and he named them. Bozozok actually is a Japanese name. So we didn't have a Japanese person in the group, but we have a Japanese named mutant. In real life, I think it should be pronounced Bozozok. Mm-hmm. in Japanese, and it means a motorcycle thug or a noisy man on motorcycle. And I told Jarema many times since then, you know, that now I have to pay the price for this name, because I always have to explain it. But another one he called Knypek, which in Polish means shorty, and that was for a mutant which was much shorter than the wild type fish, and that affected gastrulation movements. And then there was a whole family of also shorter embryos which we called Grumpy and Dopey and all the seven dwarfs.
Right.
And then I found one day another mutant which was it was shorter, but not as short as the seven dwarfs, and also had problems with pigmentation, so I had to call it Snow White.
Right. And you have another one I was reading to the literature, Van Gogh.
Sorry?
Van Gogh.
Van Gogh,
yeah.
Yes, that one had ear problems.
Right.
Yeah, and then there was another funny one that we have, that I have found, which had on one hand problem with the jaw, but then sometimes there was a problem with the heart, and once there is a problem with the heart, very often embryo develops edema, and then the jaw defect is masked by this huge edema. So when I first found the first one, I called it Dr. Jekyll, and then the next similar one was called Mr. Hyde. And then there was an entire collection of these mutants found with just shorter jaw, and we gave them all the literature doctor names, Dr. Kimball and Dr. Crusher and so on and so forth.
Right. That's great. So it sounds like it was an amazing period then. I mean, mm-hmm. You're finding all of these mutants, you're naming them in very creative ways.
Well, you know, I think that really showed our intellectual limitations.
Right. But, and then, of course, a lot mm-hmm. and everyone mentions this, a lot of papers came out of this. I think, mm-hmm. how many papers did you have? I mean, you think you had 11, 12?
Yes, 18. From this original screen, actually you probably have not seen that, but we published these papers together with Janina's Lane Volhard Lab. And there was basically all the papers, I think 11 from our lab and over 20 from Janina's Lane Lab, were published bound in a single volume of the journal Development. And that's the description, the initial description of all the mutants.
Right.
But now, I mean, at the time when we published these, we knew the mutant phenotypes. We did not know what were the genes that mutations in these mutants were affected. And since then, these mutants systematically are being characterized in molecular fashion, and there is a constant publication from my lab, from mm-hmm. labs of my colleagues and other people who simply could take these mutants, because at the time we published them, we made everything available. So right. people just could grab these mutants, and they did, and they are using them for the research.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Just for the record, this is Development, Volume 123, mm-hmm. December 1996.
Mm-hmm. It's been called Zebrafish Issue, right?
Right, it's huge. It's got some amazing photographs in it as mm-hmm. well, I should say, in any case. All right. What was your... earlier when we were talking about your graduate work, I asked what a typical day was like. Did you more or less keep the same routine as in this postdoc?
There is a little bit different routine, which is driven by the way the fish lives in the lab. And fish is, has a specific day. The light is turned on in fish facility at 8 o'clock in the morning, and fish are rhythmic in a sense that they start mating. If you set up a cross, when the light comes on, they will start mating, and then therefore they are eggs. Mm-hmm. And depending on what you want to do with them, you want to use them immediately for some injections or for some treatments with chemicals, and then you want to be in the morning at 8 o'clock sharp to collect these eggs as they are falling in the mating trap. And then the light is turned off at 10 p.m. in the evening. So mm-hmm. that in a way gives you an extent of how long you can work in fish facility.
Right.
Of course, in other rooms, the light was not regulated. So we would usually show up, depending on our experimental schedule, sometimes around 8 o'clock to do some experiments. Because I continued this project on the cytoskeleton throughout, and also I continued some other projects just to keep going with learning about the fish and the embryo. We immediately actually started to characterize some mutants. So, for example, there was a very interesting mutation that Salim, one of the students, Salim Abdelila, was characterizing, and I helped him with that a little bit. So besides just the screening, we immediately started to analyze some mutants, because we felt that it's important to eventually publish these papers, to have some characterization, but also we felt very strongly that we just need to learn much and as much as and as fast as possible as we were going through that process.
Mm-hmm.
So some mornings we would start very early and just continue to do some experiments, and then in the afternoon we would be collecting the screen crosses. The screen was done in such a way that one of us, who usually one day per week, would set up our own crosses, and that would mean setting up over 100 crosses usually in the evening, and then in the afternoon of the next day we would collect them,
mm-hmm.
and then we screened them practically every day. We screened them on day zero when we were collecting them and putting them in the dishes, and then on day one we would screen for certain aspects, basically morphology of the embryo, overall morphology, are there any defects from morphogenesis, and so on. And then on day two, that was primarily the screen for heart defects, because heart starts beating on day one, and then if something goes wrong, you see it on day two. Mm-hmm. And then on day three, there was another screen for additional aspects of development, and then the final screen was on day five. And then we, as far as the screen goes, we would decide, okay, what are there any interesting mutations that we are going to keep? And then the fish would have to be transferred to from a temporary containment to a permanent containment. And then until the next week when we would get another round of screening.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the lab very often went for lunch together. And there was a group of people, as I told you, that really liked we liked each other, and either on our own, or sometimes Wolfgang would join us. We were doing all of this in a very interesting location. The lab was part of Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School, but it was not the central Mass General campus, but it was part of this new Mass General location in Charlestown in Boston, which is in Old Navy Yard, mm-hmm. which used to be some industrial huge building, which was then completely renovated as a part of a big renovation and sort of recovery of the Navy Yard to the city. And they have done a very nice job. I think it was initially planned as a business building, but they couldn't sell it, and Mass General bought it apparently for pretty good money and made a research building out of it. So it was a beautiful building. Actually, I think the same architects were involved in that building as in this building we are here, right? And it was a Boston firm. So it was a great building, especially at the beginning when we needed a lot of space for developing methods of mutagenesis and so on. But there were a few places to go for lunch, really. There was a cafeteria downstairs and a couple of cafes, which we quickly discovered. But it was a very nice surrounding, actually, in the Navy Yard. So we would usually go for lunch either out or to cafeteria downstairs and spend some time together and just talked about everything.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think I visited Wimowasco in that Navy Yard. Mm-hmm. It's very calm, very quiet. You're right, not a lot of places to eat. There was
That's
a bagel
right.
shop, I think, down the street. but otherwise quite nice. Okay. You mentioned that one of the benefits of working in such a small lab was that you could see how a lab sort of mm-hmm. is created and how it evolves and what's involved in that process. What were you learning about the culture of science? And by the culture of science, I mean sort of the establishment of labs, recruiting people, getting funds, getting grants. What were you learning about the culture of science in mm-hmm. Drever's lab?
Well, I've seen Wolfgang interview people, and he was interviewing people, and we were interviewing the same people, and he was very much always curious what we thought about any given person who visited. Would this person fit into the lab? Would they? How we felt? And of course, he formed his own opinion, but eventually, I think he was deciding based both on what he thought and the rest of the lab thought. Mm-hmm. He was also very good about making transparent for us grants, and so whenever he would write a grant, he would give it to us to read, which, you know, of course, probably helped him a little bit, but mostly helped us, because this is when I could read grants and how, you know, how they are written, how they are being developed, especially in this new area, because for me that was still a very new area of research, and I knew that if I start my own lab, that will be one of the most important and most difficult tasks as well. But the whole group was really good about it, in a sense that once we started to go for job interviews, my colleagues were right there for me in terms of when I wrote my little resume and also research plan and research proposals. All my colleagues whom I asked would read it and comment on it, and vice versa, I would be reading their proposals. So it was really very supportive group of people, and Wolfgang would read it as well, he would, for the first seminars that we would be presenting on the forum of Mass General Hospital, or we had also a little meeting of the zebrafish community pretty regularly in Boston. There were already a few labs that started to work on zebrafish at the same time as we did. So there was a small community. We would be presenting, and initially he would want to see our presentations before they were really presented. So that was very nice. So in these terms, we were just very much part of everything that was happening, and he allowed us to see these inner workings of the machine.
Right. I had a question. Oh, Boston. How did you sort of take to Boston? How did you adjust there? Because it's quite different from Madison, as you know.
It is quite different from Madison, but in a way, it has an opinion of the most European city, so that was not a problem for me. It actually reminded me Krakow a little bit, which with its architecture or old parts of Boston, because this like 18th, 19th century style of architecture. Which I, on one hand, I really liked it, and it was a wonderful place to be for a postdoc. And that's probably the only city that I would ever consider moving in terms of a bigger city. Eventually, I got just tired of that being a big city. So we were living in Charlestown, even though my husband was working at Harvard Medical School and he had a long commute. I had a 15-minute walk, but we liked our apartment so much that we decided to stay there. Because I moved to Boston a few months before my husband. He was still finishing his PhD, but I was so eager to start on fish that I could not wait.
Right.
So on my way to Charlestown, to Navy Yard, I usually saw one tree, and I really love nature, and what I really like about Nashville right now is how green it is, and
right.
when I walk from home here, it's just a very pleasant walk, so big city eventually got to me a little bit.
Right.
But what I loved about Boston, of course, is everything that comes with it, all the wonderful concerts and just being part of the city like that. And I have to say that I also very much liked the White Mountains and Catskills Mountains, all the surroundings of the New England. One of my favorite places still in U.S. To go is Acadia National Park on the Mount Desert Island, where we spent some vacations with my husband just hiking this mountain back and forth in all possible directions. So that's actually this type of nature, which is a little bit, the mountains, White Mountains are similar to Polish Tatry. At certain point you go above the tree level and you have these spectacular views, especially in the fall with the foliage. So this I remember very fondly, because we found time to, you know, a few times per year to get out for the weekend and go to some bed and breakfast and hike with friends or just alone. So that was a very nice aspect of being in Boston. And of course, nice beaches during summer as well.
How extensive was your knowledge, I guess, of American history? Because that's another great thing about Boston. You have all these wonderful historical
that's right.
sites.
So yeah, we visited many of the places around Boston in terms of history.
And what was the arrangement? I mean, both of you come to Boston. Where did your husband work? What did he do?
He is a structural biologist. So he finished PhD in Wisconsin with John Markley, doing protein structure using magnetic resonance spectroscopy. And he joined the lab of Gerhard Wagner at Harvard Medical School, which was an excellent lab. Mm-hmm. So he had a longer commute than I did. But he was very pleased with his lab. So we would basically say goodbye in the morning and not see one another until evening, late evening usually, and then very often we still went to his lab. In the evening he could get there much quicker. By car that was just about 10 minutes in the evening,
right.
Unless there was some game in the...
Right. And that was the big dig still, now that it's finally...
The big dig actually was starting only when we were leaving.
Oh yeah,
so,
really?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It just seems to me, from what I've heard and from what I've seen, the big dick was always there, you know. But now that it's
that's
over,
that's true. You know, there was always something in Boston, and it will probably never end. That's another.
What I found interesting too, last time I was in Boston, the big dig had finished finally. They had all manner of ceremonies and whatnot, but people were beginning to miss it. They complained about it, you know, while it was underway, but now they missed it. I think they were getting nostalgic.
There was no excuse for getting late. You know?
Exactly. All right, let's talk a little bit about how you get here at Vanderbilt. You were talking about how people helped you sort of prepare your CV, and where did you apply, and then what made you decide to come here?
Mm-hmm. Right, I started to search for a job relatively early. That was just a third year. It was 1994, and I arrived in Wolfgang's lab in October of 91. So in January of 1994, I thought, well, I'll just send a few applications, just, you know, just to have practice in writing those, and who knows what will happen. In academia, there is very stringent cycle, so to speak. Most openings show up in the fall, and then a little later. So when I applied in the spring, there was very few openings. So I sent a few applications, and I got my first interview at Washington University in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And that was my first interview to which I went, which went very, very well, and I immediately got an offer.
Wow.
Then, of course, because there is a two of us, there is always this two-body problem that has to be dealt with. And unfortunately, in St. Louis at the time, they just hired somebody of the same specialty as my husband, and so there was no interest. And I had this offer standing for almost over a year, eventually could not take it because there was no opportunities for him. But right. It was a great experience for me, and I had very good interactions with people there, and that gave me some confidence for the next cycle. So the next cycle, we both applied to all possible places. Not all possible places. We were applying only to places that we knew we could go. So, for example, I did not apply to New York. I did not apply to bigger cities because I knew that it was a time for me to move to a little bit smaller city. As I told you, I was a little bit tired of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
So then, of course, I got many interviews, and Angie got many interviews. There were a few interviews in the same place. So this place immediately caught our attention because there was advertisement for by this department for either developmental biologist or structural biologist. And of course, I'm developmental biologist, and Angie is structural biologist. But we thought, well, we'll ignore or, we'll just send our applications. Later we heard the story that they really needed both, but they thought, well, we will hire one or the other this year, and then depending whom we get 1 year, we will go after the second specialty next year. And they had two separate committees, one dealing with developmental biology and other with structural biologists, and somehow in both of them independently, they found me in developmental biology and Jane structural biology, and then they realized that it's a couple. So we were invited, and we got offer here. Andrzej has had, we also had another double offer at University of Houston in Houston, and then we had some single offers. Then we decided to come here because it seemed, for me, that was definitely a very good place. There was a very good group of developmental biologists here in medical school. So I knew that for me this will be a very, very receptive environment. For my husband, we knew it will... the start will not be as easy because there was no equipment. I mean, not no, but there was equipment was not appropriate, and so we knew there might be a time of some time of waiting for the equipment to to either get grants or for the institution to fund the equipment.
Right.
But we decided to come because that was our, considering other options, that was still the best options for us as a team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I should say, I met your husband. I took mm-hmm. the wrong floor and I went mm-hmm. one up. So I met him up there. Mm-hmm. So you're very close to your labs. What was the startup package here?
Mm-hmm. From the perspective of time, at the time it was a very good startup package. On one hand, there was money for renovation of a very big room that we have found downstairs for a fish facility and setting up big facility of over 1,500 tanks. That's definitely something that was very important for me. And from the very beginning, we decided that we will actually construct it in such a way that we will be able to hire another zebrafish person in a few years and just expand the existing system. And that's exactly what happened when a couple of years later, we hired Bruce Apple, my very good colleague here. And then over $250,000 just for the rest, for putting the lab together and for research assistance. And so at the time, that was a very, very good package. I had the St. Louis experience and then having the offer in Houston as well, that was very helpful because we could compare the packages.
Right.
And so we knew that the package here was competitive for the times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, is your salary included in your grants?
Well, the salary, because this is a College of Arts and Science, we have 9 months of our salary always connected to the teaching.
Mm-hmm.
So that was included, and actually the first year of our summer salary was included as well. And then from then on, the summer salary is up to us. If we have grants, that's what we are bringing in grants, the summer salary.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. And how long did it take, I guess, to get your zebrafish mm-hmm. program up and running? How long did that take?
That happened relatively quickly. So I came here, we came here exactly January 1st, 1996, mm-hmm. 8 years ago. And almost immediately I started ordering things. My lab was not really ready at the time, and of course fish facility was not ready either, so I focused on just ordering things. And I focused on talking with people who would work on this room. I was actually glad that I could be here at the time when they were renovating the room and then oversee construction of the facility. So I focused immediately on writing the grants because I could do that. I had this wonderful collection of mutants at hand and partially characterized. I knew exactly what I wanted to do with them. So I submitted my first grant on February 1st, just a month after I arrived, and amazingly enough, it was funded.
It was, yeah.
So that was really good. But of course, at the time I was writing, I submitted it, and I started to write other grants that I submitted on a different project. So one project in the lab, from the very beginning, the lab went to routes. Connected to the two mutants we already mentioned. The Bozozoic mutant is at the heart of what we call embryonic patterning, which is where the head and where the trunk, where the tail, you know, where the central nervous system are going to be. It's one of the genes which is centrally involved in setting up what we call the organizing center, which then dictates where things are going to be in the embryo.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote one grant to NSF about Bozozoic that was not funded, but then almost immediately I was nominated for March of Dimes Birth Defect Foundation Award. And I submitted Bozozoic project for that, and that was funded. That was the Basil O'Connor Award. So immediately the two projects were funded in the first year as I've been setting up the lab. So the grant that I sent to NIH was related to CNIPEC mutant and another mutant called trilobite, very similar mutations, and another group but affecting different genes, and other mutations that also affected cell movements during development. So one big project in the lab that was the patterning, and then the other project was morphogenesis, cell movements during development. So as the grants were submitted, then I focused on just unpacking the boxes. The lab was at the time already repainted and renovated. It was in a different building at the time. And the fish facility was ordered, so everything was in place. And in March and April, I was able to offer the first rotation to students. I didn't have live fish at the time. Actually, they saw live fish in the last day of the rotation, because then the quarantine system, which eventually became a quarantine system, was installed in the lab. And the first few fish were I brought actually with me, coming from a fish meeting in Cold Spring Harbor. So the first fish arrived, and the students could see the fish. They were working with fixed embryos, because I brought with me a whole collection of mutant embryos, which are fixed in Boston, and they could actually do some stainings and some analysis on these fixed embryos. So that was very, very fast progression as the other things were falling in place. Therefore, in May, one of the students decided to join my lab, and at the time the quarantine system was up and running and we had fish, she could start to work. And then I interviewed, also in the meantime, I interviewed for a research assistant, and I found a very amazing research assistant who later became my graduate student, and both this research assistant, Florence Marlowe, and my first graduate student, Kim Ficaney, it's part of the success of this group. They were really fantastic people, very nice people, and I think that later encouraged other people to join the lab. So that was a very good first half of a year, and then in the summer the fish facility was installed. So we had these 1,500 tanks that needed to be populated by by fish, it was a challenge at the time to raise fish a little bit, because the baby fish needed very special food, like paramecia or